Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Great to see you all. Hello, everybody, and welcome to RSA House. We're in the great room here. And to those joining us in Japan and around the world, in Japan we should be saying good evening. I hope you've had a very nice day, and we're going to give you, we hope, a very nice evening, at least for the next hour, because after that, you're on your own. This is very exciting and technical and technological and what could possibly go wrong, but we are simulcasting, ladies and gentlemen, with our partners at the UK Pavilion at Expo 2025 Osaka. And we are connecting experts here with experts over there to talk about how to make progress in something that it feels like we've been talking about for an awfully, awfully long time, namely gender equity. We've got some fantastic speakers here and some fantastic speakers in Osaka. Here with me in the room is Penny East, the COO of the Fawcett Society, and we also have Sakshi Bansal, the senior strategy consultant and psychologist working in grassroots for gender and education, and also part of the G20 delegation for the UK this year. The whole point of an expo event really is to talk about universal challenges, and I think gender equity, providing the means by which everyone has a chance to succeed regardless of their gender, is very, very high on that list, and some would say it needs to be a lot higher. So I'm so pleased that we're talking about this today. Now, to open our conversation, ladies and gentlemen, cross all your fingers, I am going to hand over to our co-chair, Carolyn Davidson, the UK Commissioner General for Expo 2025. Over to you in Osaka, Carolyn. I hope you can hear me. We can see you.
Hooray. I think we're all cheering for the technology. But thank you very much, Nina, for that introduction. Good evening, everybody, from a very warm and slightly sweaty Osaka. It's great to be connected with everybody, both in the great room of the RSA, but also around the world as well. Many thanks to everybody for joining. The theme of Osaka Expo 2025 is designing future society for our lives. You cannot design a sustainable future without gender equity and justice. I think we all know that. We're just sometimes not terribly good at putting it into practice. So we are here today to talk about some of the common challenges and opportunities around that. This week, Expo is Peace, Security and Human Dignity Week, so it seems a particularly good week to be talking about this subject. I'd also like to say that it is also Ukraine's National Day today here at Expo. I will introduce our panel members in a moment, but we're very honoured to have somebody from Ukraine on our panel on this, their very special day at Expo. The UK-Japan partnership is the strongest it has been in years. We collaborate on all sorts of things, defence, security, science, innovation, and trade and investment. We're at slightly opposite ends of the global gender gap, but as I said, we share many common challenges and opportunities. We might be at opposite ends, but actually Japan tops education and health practically every year, which the UK does not do. So, you know, we might get some things right, we clearly don't get other things right. So this is an opportunity. And I think what we want to do today is talk about not what doesn't work, but what does work, and see where it is we can learn from each other. So let me introduce our panelists. I'm very happy to be joined by Chika Sudo, who is head of art at the British Council here in Japan, and Natalia Matsenko, who's a Ukrainian curator, art critic, and lecturer. And without further ado, let me pass back to you, Nina, in the great room.
Okay, we'll get a glimpse of the panelists at some point, so we're just imagining what they look like. So thank you, but there they are, hello. That's a great panel, and it's lovely to see you all there. So yeah, let's start off here. We've got Penny and Sakshi next to me. You know, you just heard from Carolyn. It's you know, how can you have progress without proper gender equity and justice? It's a basic thing, isn't it, Sakshi?
Indeed. Well, first of all, ohayo gozaimasu to my colleagues, friends, audience in Japan, and good morning, everyone here. My dad spent a long time in Japan, so it's very close to my heart. It's lovely that I've got Osaka in the room.
You have indeed.
And your question on, or just a comment, right, on
yeah.
It is a very basic thing. We should get that right.
Yeah.
But I think it is the most basic things that we haven't got right at the moment. So with my work with Arab, working on cities, built environment, infrastructure, you think that infrastructure would just work. You go to the airport and you know that as a female you need X, Y, and Z services and they will be readily available to you. But the amount of airports in the world when they were designed by great architects and designers who didn't think about it, who didn't think about their wives or kids or daughters or sisters traveling with them when they were using these facilities is absolutely shocking to me.
Give me an example of that, Sakshi. That sounds worrying and intriguing.
Well, not too long ago, we had to rally for the fact that you need baby changing rooms and you need breastfeeding rooms at airports. That wasn't very long ago, and that wasn't a normal practice to have those at the airports. Now, do I choose when the baby needs a change, or do I choose when I need to breastfeed? No. And you spend 14 hours, 12 hours, 3 hours at airports? Of course you need those facilities. A lot of your passengers are women. You think that passenger airlines or airports who want more and more passengers, more and more customers, want to make the money, would think about 50% of the population or more that's trying to travel and have a good time and have a stress-free time like anyone else. But actually, airports were designed for business travelers or for people who are paying for the flight tickets. That weren't necessarily women. So, shocking.
Penny, it's 2025, okay? Why are we still hearing stories like that?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, I think in 2025, it's important to remember there is progress being made, absolutely. And when Labour came to power last year, there were a number of pledges in their manifesto around closing the gender pay gap, around really tackling things like violence against women and girls, where they've got a 50% target. Unfortunately, we still have a huge way to go, but we have seen progress in the last 12 months of government introducing legislation to try and tackle some of these systemic issues that we're talking about today. Things like the Employment Rights Bill has a real focus on things like flexible working, on banning NDAs, which is an absolute win for the women's sector. The NDAs have been used to silence women for far too long, and that's due to brilliant, brilliant campaigners who have been advocating for those policy shifts over a really long time.
As you say, Penny, we have had new legislation, and now companies that employ over a certain number of people are legally required to talk about what the gender pay gap is, and that definitely has had an impact. And I'm just looking at a statistic here that says that 78% of large UK employers still report a gender pay gap in favour of men. So it has had an impact. It's had an impact in my organisation and in my working life, certainly, but I thought that the impact would be bigger, I'll be honest.
Yeah, and I think actually last year, Fawcett Society found in its own data analysis that the gender pay gap widened for the first time in around a decade in the UK. So it's absolute progress is not linear, right? It's not that every year it gets better. As I say, there are bits of legislation going through Parliament at the moment that we hope will have a real impact on the gender pay gap. The Chancellor's made it one of her pledges to close that gender pay gap, but we just need to make sure that we look at the entire infrastructure around that. I think sometimes people focus on the policies within a workplace, but actually it's affordable childcare, it's shared parental leave, it's an even split of domestic duties in the house. It's all of those things that mean that women are less able to flourish economically and in their career because they lack that infrastructure around it. So policy and legislation can go so far, but actually it needs that infrastructure as well.
I mean, Taksha, you represented the UK at the G20. Did you have a feeling that this is high on the agenda, equity and equality?
Absolutely. Every single nation had equality and equity very high on the agenda. I mean, just doing youth consultations, which is what we did for a long period of time, talking to young people across the UK, listening to what their needs are, what do they want in terms of policy shifts. Equity comes up. And I like to repeat one something that one of the young persons said who was in the room. They said, we do not want lazy solutions. Don't tell us that let's not grow. Don't tell us let's not develop. That's lazy. We want actual, real, hard solutions that will actually work. And that often looks like having the tough conversations and saying, we aren't doing well. I think as the UK, sometimes we aren't that good at saying we aren't doing that well, you know, for various different reasons. We don't pause and reflect and say, we could have done better. So actually, in your introduction at in Osaka, it was really refreshing to hear that we don't do that, and Japan is doing that really well. Yeah. Can we learn that? And the other thing that came up in the policy negotiations is, how do we look at countries which are not necessarily the developed countries as we have called them in the past? How do we look at other countries and learn from them? So there are examples in Kenya, or there are examples in India, micro examples that have actually done really well when it comes to education balance and gender, or have done really well in putting girls back into school. Typically, you look at some of these countries and you always focus on the problems. But could we focus on the solutions, community-based solutions that can actually work, okay, which, you know, takes it away from policy and back into our own hands?
Okay, community-based solutions. Let's go back to Osaka now, and Carolyn and the panel over there. You've heard my panelists here talk about the gender pay gap and how we can learn, perhaps, from other countries. Perhaps we can learn a little bit about what's happening in Japan, and also the role that art can actually have in forwarding very important subjects like this. So, Carolyn, over to you.
Thank you very much. I think that's a really good point. The power of art, the power of storytelling, I think is absolutely crucial, because it's so important in terms of how you connect with other people and how you persuade. So maybe I could start by asking you, Chika-san, how can sort of arts and cultural institutions, how do they work as drivers of gender equity, not only in Japan, but beyond? Mm. And what do you think, what have you seen that gives you grounds for hope, I suppose? Because I think we all need hope as well.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. So maybe let me start a brief explanation about Japan's kind of fundamental kind of issues around gender equality as a kind of basic understanding. So when we talk about the gender equality in Japan, the statistics are quite disappointing, I have to say. So Japan was ranked 118th among 142 according to the recent gender gaps index. And in arts and cultural sectors, we also have, we are also facing the same challenges. But from my experience, I've been seeing so many female workers in this industry. For example, the curators at museums, or the production coordinator roles for the theaters. But when it comes to the leadership roles, like artistic directors or museum directors or the executive producers, these senior leadership roles are mostly dominated by male. And it's not just my impression, but there are several kind of surveys conducted by the sector specialists and academic institutions. So I think there will be three main challenges which avoid kind of making Japan society more kind of gender equality country. So one is the kind of, there is a historical context where the childcare and housework tends to be unevenly distributed among women. So that's making it really hard to women to build career, especially in the full-time capacity. That's one challenge. And the other one is that there is a, maybe relating to the first challenge, but there are a lack of visible role models in the industries. So there are some kind of artistic director or super kind of curator who is really known, quite successful career, but people thinks that, oh, these women are quite like superwomen. So we cannot see them as a role models. Mm. So I think we really need to increase these kind of role models more in the near future. And the last challenge is that about job mobility. So there is not much job mobility or fluidity in art sector. So once the women decides to take a time off to raise their children, for example, 3-4 years ago, it's really difficult to return to the original position. So that kind of job mobility thing is a challenge. But I'm also seeing the positive changes recently. So one of the things is that we have more female director roles in the museums, such as Mori Kataoka, Mami Kataoka at Mori Art Museum, and also Mika Kuraya at Yokohama Art Museum. These are all kind of major leading art museums, so that's a good sign. And also galleries and the theater are trying to present more gender-themed performances or exhibitions to kind of raise awareness among the all the general public. So that's another good thing. And additionally, what I heard from my performing arts contact, the younger generation, they are trying to seek more flexible way of working, so that if the couple are working in the same arts industry, trying to kind of, they don't want to sacrifice one of the partner's career. So they are trying to find the work-life balance as a couple. So that's, I think, quite good change. So, and as a one example, I've heard that the male directors, theater directors, now they, some of them are trying to make the rehearsal stage, the rehearsal space of the theater more kind of children, child-friendly. So that not just that the director himself, but all the kind of production team who have children, they have a choices what to bring their kids to the rehearsal. So, and I've heard that in the end, that whole production itself became really, really inclusive one. So it's really affecting in the kind of production itself. So I think at this stage, these changes are quite small, but once these actions and voices become bigger in the near future, I think these arts professionals or cultural institution can be a powerful driver to make a change in Japan, Japanese society.
I think you raised a very relevant point there about the director, even if it's a male director, making a more inclusive space. This is not something that we are going to solve by just women coming together and saying we want X, Y. You know, we have, this has to be about equity. This has to be about male and female. And it's about, as you say, about the men being able to bring their kids to work in the same way as the women. You know, we are not, this is not about only fighting for one sector of society. How do you think there is much evidence yet in Japan in those cultural institutions led by men of that sort of leadership? Or is it still very much something that is being driven more by female leaders and directors? Do you see more male allies also appearing in the cultural space? Or is it very much something that's being driven by the female, directors and curators?
I think for younger generations, the male The example I mentioned was that one, the male director.
Yeah.
So they were trying to reconsidering their work in work-life balance and trying to kind of, as a couple, if they are working in the same arts industries, they try to not sacrifice the career of one of them. So I think quite good.
Good.
Even small, but I think if they these actions or voices become bigger.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Natalia, if I can turn to you, I think, as I said, the power of art is to tell the story. And I felt that very much this morning. We were at the National Day Hall for the Ukraine flag raising ceremony for Expo. We had a performance by Unoka, a Ukrainian band. And, you know, the message around resilience, around determination, and emotion, I think that they were able to convey through their music was really strong. So how do you see the role of art in challenging these perceptions or the sort of stereotypes that exist across society?
Thanks a lot, Caroline. And very warm welcome, just as you said, like very warm greetings to everyone here in Osaka and at RSA in London. Thank you very much for being here, and I'm really proud to be here. Thank you for having me. And actually, what brought me to Osaka, it is my activity as a curator. Mm. So it was a great coincidence that now it's all like happening at the same time, and we have National Day. And I'm grateful to you for mentioning this, of course, and we're grateful for this solidarity, like to many countries, many people around the world. What brought me to Osaka, I am co-curating here an exhibition of 30 contemporary Ukrainian artists that is called Home Beyond the Dawn. Mm-hmm. And it's taking place at the Romania Pavilion. They are hosting it as an immersive experience. So if you have time, you're very welcome to attend. And this exhibition, it's actually for me one of these examples, because what I really like from the start of this conversation, it's this practical focus, because I think, as Nina mentioned already in the beginning of the conversation, it's like it's so long that we're having these discussions, we're speaking about this, but it's really nice that we can speak about action and we can do action. And we have practitioners who are really acting to make some change and not only to speak about it, it's like possibility. And so for me also this question, it's very practical, and my curatorial practice, it's very much about this. I think that the work of the curator, it's something that gives you this power, this possibility to highlight, to empower the voices that maybe are underrepresented somehow. And I think for these women voices, it's something very relevant. And in our exhibition, we also have, like, unfortunately for me, it's like I'm bringing with me, being a Ukrainian currently, I would love to speak just about gender balance and equity, but unfortunately I'm bringing also like another context with me, which is tough, and this is the context of war. But now for us it's really impossible to divide anything, because everything that you are doing, all the actions, all the ideas that you're sharing, it's like still intertwined with this context of war, with this experience of war. And basically the arts are now for us both the instrument for women to like to fight for their rights, or like to work for their rights, to be in dialogue, because basically, as was already mentioned, the changes are happening. So luckily we have this opportunity to be in dialogue sometimes, not just to fight, and that's also precious. But on the other hand, war, of course, it's something like, it's a very brutal thing from the point of view of social environmental systems. It's a catastrophe in which you still have to survive and to act and to persist. And art in this sense is a very powerful instrument, which sometimes might seem helpless, but then if you continue, if you persist in this, then you understand that it works. And basically I just came to this panel I was running because I was just moderating recently another panel, also on occasion of the National Day of Ukraine, and as a frame of public program of our exhibition, and it was called Women Artists at War. And I had three brilliant speakers. One of them, she is a participant of our exhibition. Maybe if we have time, I can share in more detail. Another one, she's a cultural manager and one of the people who made the Ukrainian pavilion at Expo Osaka. And another one, she's a combat veteran. So she went voluntarily to the front line, like to fight for her country, but she's also a person with a cultural background. And we've been speaking with them, how was it for them? And what is the function of arts for them as women facing the war? So basically for me, it now feels so like naturally now to dive into this conversation. And I could say that now from my own experience and for example, our exhibition that we're having here, we have the stories of very powerful women artists that are facing the war right now, but they are still like continuing to work to share their stories globally as artists, as women, as Ukrainians. Like each of them, of course, has their own accents and perspectives. And some of them have never positioned themselves as feminists, for example. But then one of these artists, she went also like the same as Hannah, whom I just mentioned. We also have in our project an artist named Sofia Pomahaibo, who just went when the full-scale invasion started. She went to the army and now she cannot continue her work as an artist, but what she's doing now, also as a creative person, as a person with this like really flexible way of thinking, finding solutions, making the change, she's really now fighting for her rights as a woman in the army, which is, I guess you all know, is one of the most patriarchal systems in the world. And there is still like a separate topic of this underrepresentation of women. And I must say that in Ukrainian army, for example, in recent years, like this number and percentage of women is growing and the role and the rights are also being developed. It's still, of course, a very big issue. And you can ask like every woman that is there, like she can tell you. But on the other hand, there is also the progress. And I would say that for these women whom I know and with whom I worked, who are from the artistic field, even if they are not able to continue their artistic practice, they still can implement their skills, their way of thinking to make this change, and it works. And actually, it was interesting to hear this note about generations, because one of the insights that Sofia, who is now fighting, shared with me, she said that, you know, when I'm facing like my colleagues, like combatants from the older generation, you always have this, oh no, you're a girl, you're not allowed to do this, or please let me like carry this. And she's always fighting, she's always doing this herself, but she says that with younger people, like younger men, like you have much less of this problem. So I would say that even such a conservative, masculine system, patriarchal system as army can be changed through these women perspective, and there is no other way. So you cannot change the army and make it more inclusive for the women without inserting women in it. And even if it's not like in our case, it's not the choice like that we made voluntarily, unfortunately we were forced to do so, but still it shows like this power. And if we're speaking just about arts and it's empowering and sharing the stories, so yeah, I can say that again, getting back to our exhibition, sorry that I'm like so focused on this, but basically, yeah, that was something that brought me here. And it's sharing the stories of home. It's called Home Beyond the Dawn. And just as was already mentioned by you, like about this resilience and home that we need. This project is about stories from 30 artists that are telling about the change and transformation of the concept of home during wartime, and about its loss, about its preservation, protection, and reconstruction. So basically, it's a project that is also looking towards future, towards this hope, and really resonating with the topic of the Expo this year, and also with the topic of this thematic week, of course. And these voices of the women artists in this project, I think they really work, like on one hand, highlighting the women rights, both like civilians that are facing the war, and like women who are artists and militants. And on the other hand, it's not just like the conversation about women, but it's actually about this, again, as you mentioned, that we are not fighting for domination, we are fighting for the dialogue, for the possibility to hear each other. So like, to me, equity, it's also about sensitivity. And it's extremely hard not to lose sensitivity in times of war, for example. It's very tough times, as I said, brutal times. And I'm, of course, speaking from the name of a Ukrainian person, but that's also important to remember that it's an experience that, unfortunately, so many people in the world, are so many women in the world, are going through right now. And I would like to have more of this international dialogue. I'm so happy to be able to be here today and to share these international experiences, because I think that's this ability to stay sensitive and to hear each other, that's something that art can also do, and that's how it can help us to reach our goals. Thank you. Sorry,
You didn't speak too long at all. You had a really important message to share, and we're very grateful to you for doing it. And yeah, I think, you know, we all applaud the resilience of Ukraine. And I would just say that Home Beyond the Dawn, which is the Romanian pavilion, is next door to the UK one. So very handy. So very easy to go and visit it after you've been here. But maybe I'll pass back to you, Nina, in the great room.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Chika and Natalia. Plenty of food for thought there. That word resilience came up quite a lot, didn't it? It's clear that there is a lot of progress being made in some fields. We heard the panelists there talk about the art world, for example, and voices in the army. Why is it so much better in some and not the others? That's a bit of a sweeping question, Sakshi, for you.
Well, I'll start with the word resilience, if that's okay. A couple of years ago, I had a privilege of contributing to a book on resilience in modern organizations. It's a fascinating book because it has a chapter on military and what we learn from the military on resilience. My chapter focuses on community practices and what resilience means for communities. And actually, one of the topics or questions we explored is, why do we love resilience so much? Because resilience comes with a burden as well, right? A lot of us and our threshold for risk and our threshold for, sorry for the word, BS that we take has increased quite a lot. Because we put all of that under the umbrella of we are resilient. And so we have taken a lot of hard hits over the years under the term resilience. And I think we need to relook at resilience a little bit and say, how long until we continue to say success and good work is what you achieve individually? Can we start thinking about resilience in terms of how we came together as a community and achieved something, when success was a metric of how together we made an effort and something changed or something stuck? So I think resilience is a difficult word. We need to use it cautiously. Touting everything as resilience can be quite harmful. There's a burden that comes with it. And same for the ideas of success. Now, reimagination and rehabilitation, that's interesting. Our colleagues use the word reconstruction. Arab's been working in Ukraine on reconstruction and how do we reconstruct. I was involved in a project on asking the question, what do we reconstruct? So when cities have seen natural hazards or wars or famine, and then there is this need to reconstruct, what do we reconstruct first? Who do we reconstruct for? Are we reconstructing for the whole society or for the working class? Who is the working class? Is it men? Is it women? Is it both? Are we reconstructing where you pray, because that's more important for the community? Are you reconstructing first for hospitals, because that's what is needed? Who will work in the hospitals? So just thinking about people in that sense, cities in that sense, how do we use them? In some areas, we have opportunities to rethink cities, which I think is the pearl in the chaos. And then you have already constructed organizations, infrastructure, mechanisms, and then you have one president that comes and takes position in power and all of the good work over the years goes out of the window, right? We all know who we are talking about. And And when gender and all the good work that civil society did or charity sector did for years in some countries went out of the window, people started asking the question, were we never resilient enough? Mm. Or were the systems not built to be resilient? Or was this never really sustainable? All the work that we did in gender, in pay gap, in having these systems put in place, these checks and balances put in place, it all went out of the window in literally a month. You know, the charity sector completely came to a pause. So how do we make some of the work that we are doing today stick and sustainable? And I always go back to the idea that when we started sort of designing, for example, as I said in the beginning, these airports, the engineers, the architects, the designers, or when you talk about AI and, you know, the technologists or economists that were sat together in one room to create these solutions, we did not have psychologists in the room. We did not have anthropologists in the room. We did not have activists in the room. A lot of siloed work existed to create solutions that weren't solving anything, or they weren't considering intersectionality, or they weren't considering human behavior, or they weren't considering history and art and culture and everything else, you know, ecology.
So you're saying there needs to be women in the room?
There needs to be all sciences, all disciplines, all genders in the room.
I mean, do you think, Penny, that having that idea of having women in the room, mm-hmm. I mean, it puts a lot of pressure on the women in the room, doesn't it, really, in a sense, yeah. that, you know, that we have to drive it. And that might be part of the issue, that it can't just be left to, you know, the minority group if, in the company, if you like, to make the change.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think particularly in a UK context, we're talking about a real backlash against equality and diversity within workplaces, that mindset shift of kind of people criticising the fact that there are EDI roles, that there are EDI strategies. We've seen a lot within public services and local government, a very vocal criticism of those kinds of roles. And I think it's really important that it's not just women that stand up against that backlash, to say that actually equality, diversity and inclusion strategies and indeed professionals are playing a very vital role within those services. And that kind of culture war conversation, where there's a real backlash against that, it needs both men and women to stand up against that. Particularly over the next kind of 3 to 4 years in the build up to the next election in the UK, we have to be able to advocate for it and make sure that there isn't a shift to the right that means that those roles and those strategies start to become diluted.
You're right, it's a very critical moment. We've spoken about this a little bit earlier on today, so progress has been made. I think we can say that progress has been made. And now we're in a new era, and we're in the era of AI. And I know this is something that both of you have been involved in looking at, and Penny, there are some quite disturbing things that you have uncovered that are happening right now without a lot of us even knowing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think with AI and gender, a lot of the conversation over the last recent years have been on direct harm, so things like deepfake pornography, which is absolutely abhorrent. There is a lot of change going on to try and get the legislation to catch up with those changes. But I think at Fawcett, we're also looking at how AI is being used in the workplace and that kind of insidious dismantling of some progress that has been made. So, for example, AI systems being biased against women within recruitment. So using AI in recruitment tools, it's been shown that they are disproportionately more likely to reject women because of the way that they're monitoring language, the way that they're monitoring things like career breaks. Also productivity tools in AI, where things like they're measuring mouse strokes or emails sent per hour. That is very hard to see how that continues while also advocating for flexible working, understanding that women and indeed men have caring responsibilities and how to create inclusive workspaces. These things feel contradictory. The other thing that we're very concerned about at Fawcett is also the, particularly in public services and the NHS, this real move to AI automation and what happens to the workforce that are going to lose their jobs as a product of that. It's not to say that AI is bad, but it's just to say that there needs to be plans in place for workforces that are disproportionately held up by women. What happens to those women who will lose their jobs when AI automation? I mean, in the NHS 10-year plan that just got published a few weeks ago, it said that they want every hospital in the country to be AI automated within the next decade. There has to be a work plan for that. There has to be looking at the NHS workforce, which, as I say, is disproportionately held up by women. What is the plan there? So I think with AI, it's very complex. There's lots of different elements. It's used in lots of different ways. But we need to make sure that gender bias, which exists within those data sets and exists within those tools, isn't being further embedded, because it's essentially being disseminated far too quickly without the necessary safeguards and without the necessary experts in the room who will be looking at it through that intersectional lens.
We need to talk about that a lot more, I think, don't we? I mean, you have been involved in a project, actually, where you've spoken to a lot of young people about AI and its impact in the world and what they want for it. Is this notion of making sure that gender equality is still very high on the agenda, is that still something that people of that generation are aware is an issue and needs to be addressed and they need to be across? Is that what you found?
Absolutely. Their understanding of AI is fabulous, right? They inherently understand what all and some of us actually feel a bit fearful of or a bit unsure about.
Yes.
I think it was very clear that we all want ethics and governance around AI and that to be discussed and talked, and there is no perfect solution as of now. How do we govern something that we don't even understand, and how do you ring-fence it? Should we ring-fence it? There's a larger debate around who should control AI and the deployment of AI. Is that government? Will that be restricted to the public access? You know, currently we have free access to AI. Will that be restricted in the future? And that, again, disproportionately impacts people who are in power, disproportionately men, who will then get access to a very powerful tool that women might not have access to. So it's not just about the harmful impact of AI, but also the use and the access to such a powerful system in place. Now, it's interesting because a lot of the challenges with AI that we currently face were built 10, 20 years ago, right? AI was trained to be biased because of the materials, the media, the learnings that existed 10, 20 years ago, which it has used over years to train itself. So one of the things we can start doing today is to put the right research, media, and content out there just by ourselves. What are we producing? What are we consuming? What are we suggesting is the right thing to read and not read? Is so much more critical than ever, because it's not just us consuming it, it's AI systems consuming it, and it will live in their brains forever. It will train them forever. It will multiply forever. So I think there is absolutely that on what we're consuming and putting out there. I think the second with young people is you know, pornography is a big one that UK has been advocating for against the use of deepfake for pornography, and actually we are working with other countries as well to understand what the implications are. And how do you actually safeguard our young children and population and anybody actually against it? So absolutely top of the agenda, but I think we need to include young people in the education of it. A lot of policies, funnily enough, are aimed at educating young people about AI. I think they can educate us about AI.
Yeah.
And policies aren't worded like that. They don't think about that, which I think is absolutely shocking.
That's a fantastic suggestion of a solution. I mean, Penny, if you could wave a magic wand, what do you think is, I mean, the most powerful thing right now to forward the work that you do at Fawcett, which you're all about gender equality and having a voice and progressing. Women have struggled for a long time, you know, for over centuries for equality. You must reach a point when you think, oh, I don't want to be the one that stands up and embarrasses myself and says that's not wrong. It takes a lot of bravery from me. What is the thing that needs to change fundamentally? Is it at a government level, policy level? What is it?
I think, wow, what is that? I mean, that point about bravery, can I just say, when I actually took this job, I've only been chief exec for a few months, and I actually had other kind of female campaigners who have been doing it for much longer message me to say, be prepared for what you're going to get online. So, and actually, I was chatting to a researcher only a few weeks ago who is a counter-terrorism expert, an academic at the LSE, and he's now looking at misogyny, and he says he gets more threats and more aggressive and threatening emails and messages than he ever did when he was looking at anything around counter-terrorism. So I think, yeah, sorry to depress there. But I think that point about bravery and that point about it can't be up to women to continue to stand up and advocate, because actually, There's nothing a misogynist loves more than having a go at a strong woman. And actually, feminists standing up and speaking, it's like bees to honey, you know? And so it needs male allies. It needs men to stand up. It can't be a women's issue to solve, not just because it's not morally right, but also because it's ineffective. Because what we are dealing with, whether it's teenage boys, whether it's older men, whether it's, I don't want to use his name, Andrew Tate, but whether, and all of that, that can't be solved by women alone, because not only is it, as I say, not right, but it's ineffective, because men like Andrew Tate and all the million, the thousands of mini Andrew Tates, they like it when women like me get angry. They like it. That's what they're aiming for. What they need is strong men from lots of different parts of society standing up and saying, this is unacceptable. It can't be down to women to respond to it only, because it won't work. And so in terms of one solution or one other, I think that's something that we really care about at Fawcett, is supporting men, standing alongside men to be allies with us in this real growing fight against the rise of misogyny and sexism, particularly online, but it's having real life effects and online effects, and we need to be working together to solve it.
Yeah, I mean, I do get the impression that we're talking about this now like never before. I mean, programmes like Adolescence, for example, they play an important role. I'm just at this point going to open this up and see if anyone's got any questions. We've got a question there at the back. Microphone coming your way. It's a fascinating conversation. Go on for another hour, but...
Thanks.
Yes.
Hi. My name's Sagar. My interest is in systems change, supply chains. So when I say this or ask this, is from a global perspective. And yes, of course, women, men, equal, in the boardroom, wherever it is. But there's one issue that I've been raising for the last 10 years, especially in the climate sector, that seems to be admonished every single time. And when I look at it in a supply chain, then it's not somewhere in Yorkshire or Edinburgh, is somewhere all the way in India, or Chile, or Congo. What could I be talking about? And in this space, there's no worries about equality or diversity of women. There's tons of women, and there's tons of children, and there's a lot of men. This area I'm talking about that we do not talk about at all, because it might be too disruptive to the net zero sector. How many children, girls and boys and women, are enslaved in a Congo mine for cobalt and lithium? Yes, of course, have equality for women, changing room and all these other places I can't recollect. But when you've got hundreds of thousands of men, women and children, where there's no issues of gender equality in a mine, in Congo and all other parts of Africa and Chile and possibly India, where the Adivasi tribes are. And we're talking about this stuff. And I was like, yeah, of course, talk about it. But you've got women and girls who are then taken through sex and slave labor trafficking. So if we're talking about pornography, fine. But we are not talking about these children and the women and the girls who are taken through the labor and sex trafficking to mine the minerals that we need for this Green New Deal.
Okay,
and
well,
10 years later, I'm shocked that we don't even talk about it.
Let's take a response. That just highlights how vast this subject is and how different and difficult it is globally to get a handle on it. And Sakshi, I know you've done a lot of work abroad with different communities.
Yeah, Sagar, thanks for that. Did I get your name right? Sagar.
Yes.
Nobody, I think, can stand up here and disagree to that. I think that the cause and the issue that we are highlighting today is not very dissimilar from what you're highlighting. In different rooms where you sit in the world, the vastness of the cause, the depth of the cause, the challenge and the problem vary. We have worked, so I've been working with my charity for 12 years now. 6 years of that, it was spent in India working with girls, young girls who were not in school. And these girls were forced into child labor and much worse practices. And I was very young by myself at that time. I was 16 when I thought I had all the answers. And one of the challenges we faced to go and support young girls coming back into schools was not even knowing their whereabouts. You can't track a young girl's whereabouts for 24 hours in Delhi and where she goes and who she meets and what she does to bring her back to school. I think one thing I learned at that time was data is very important. Not just the fancy data you see published and hypothesized and theorized, the data of how and where our people are and what they're doing. I don't think, and I agree with you, I don't think enough people care about it. And I do think that if people started caring about it, we wouldn't have a lot of things we have today, and it will inconvenience a lot of people. Completely agree with you. But I think data is important. If you have the data, if you are close to people, if you have stories, please share them, please talk about them, and actually find people who can help on a local level. I think supporting charities is great, and I think that's critical, but in some instances, it's the local community that can do much better help and first aid and support and can lead to long-term solutions. So please, let's find those people that can help us.
Thank you for that question. Thank you, Sakshi. We'll probably take one more question. And then before we go back to Osaka, Lexter, yes, it's you.
Thank you, and thank you for a very interesting discussion. My name's Carol Stewart, and you've touched on intersectionality, but what are your thoughts on how we can ensure that when it comes to gender equity initiatives, that it is done through an intersectional lens?
Okay. Penny? Yeah,
certainly. So the government at the moment, are, in terms of the gender pay gap, are actually doing a consultation on race and disability and how it intersects with gender, because women from minoritized backgrounds, disabled women, the pay gap increases. And so we need to absolutely understand how it intersects. I think there is a commitment from government to look at it, and certainly it's about gathering the voices and experiences of lots of different women in lots of different communities and making sure that we've got the data analysis to show how it's going to widen that gender pay gap, which is what Fawcett has been doing over the last few months, is working with government on that legislation and on that policy consultation. But it's a really good point. It's about how to include the voices, make sure they're part of the conversation, but also about data, getting back to that data point to make sure it's as diverse as possible.
I think we need to listen to people who don't agree with the idea of EDI in an organization. We really need to listen to them and not disregard them. Why do they think EDI doesn't work, right? Because it inconveniences some people in power or position. Because it's an added cost to the organization. Because the effects aren't felt. And we really need to start looking at why is it not working? Why is it an inconvenience, right? I think a couple of, and this is a controversial opinion, but I think EDI should be able to link to the financial outcomes of an organization. If it doesn't, it's not working. And if it's not linked, it's not going to stick, right? So we need to be able to do that for actually intersectional solutions to work for a company. Otherwise, you know.
Yeah. That's an argument I've definitely heard. At this point, I think we are going to flawlessly cross to Osaka, ladies and gentlemen, and see if you've got any questions over there, Carolyn.
I'm going to open it up to our audience here in the UK Pavilion.
Thank you. Tanya Koch, I'm a fellow of the RSA and director of a theatre company here in Osaka, Tarinai Nanika. If I may, quickly, one observation. I just wonder if anyone here agrees with me. There's one sector of society in Japan, which for me is a huge role model. Chika-san, you were talking about role models. Japanese grannies. Does anyone agree with me? I have met so many remarkable Japanese ladies in their 80s and 90s that are the epitome of resourcefulness and grace and strength and optimism. And I wonder if we can bottle whatever they've got. That was just one observation. And then a question, I think for you, Carolyn. It seems to me, this is a complete, jump in topic. It seems to me that if we had more women in politics, it would take maybe longer before we would descend into war in many circumstances. Thinking about the implications on life, you know, having produced life, would there be an extra, hesitation before bringing about war. And I wonder whether that's whether you think that's right. And obviously that would have lots of implications. What do you think about that, Carolyn?
I think the UK has been a real champion of what we call the Women, Peace and Security agenda, because I think we recognise, and you know, to go back to the point before, the data proves that, for example, peace treaties and peace agreements last longer if there are women in the room when they are agreed. And solutions are found more easily if there are women in the room. So I think it is a really powerful point. And I think there was some data research a couple of years ago about the number of peace agreements that were signed or agreed that year, and the proportion of them that had women or women's groups involved in them was woefully low. And surprise, surprise, very few of them were sustainable. So I think it's a really important point. I think this week in particular, when we're talking about peace, security and human dignity, you know, it's not just for one group of people. And, you know, if you want a sustainable society, then you need everybody to be involved in shaping it. So I think, you know, it's something that we have done a lot of work on. We've worked with UN Women, for example, and we've worked with other UN organisations on this. And it's something that, I think it is recognised. But I don't know whether, Natalia, you have any thoughts on that, given your perspective from where you come from.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thank you for this note and for your comments. Actually, yeah, that's a very relevant topic. And I would say that, to me, I think it's really important that we have these numbers, you know, that we have this data. Because if we would speak just from the perspective of some stereotype or prejudice, that of course the war is a male thing, and it would not be war there if only women would rule the world. If we just speak it from, you know, from some stereotype position, then it's one thing. But if we have real numbers that prove that, that's another thing. And I think that, of course, generally, I would agree that from my experience, of dialogues and general political situation, of course, the more women who have voice you have, I think the more constructive dialogue could happen. So basically, I believe that these numbers can be like that, because actually I didn't know these statistics. That's very interesting to me. And what would be a small note from my side also to your comment about grannies, because I can say that I heard a lot about actually Japanese grannies, and because my professor at the art academy when I studied, she's a Japanese, so she spent all her whole life searching about Japanese culture, so she was telling us a lot, and I'm happy finally to be here physically. I can say that, for example, in Ukraine, in my background, our granny is also absolutely fantastic role model, and my granny is not alive anymore, but she came through the Second World War. She survived it, and as many people of this generation, they had this experience also. So basically, those of them who stayed, these women, there were examples of extremely powerful women, and these generations will always for us is some kind of role model, of course traumatized, just as we will be now. And we were sometimes laughing, you know, that we will be now these grannies that someday will tell to our kids and grandkids, and they will be like, oh my god, this granny again telling these stories from her youth in war. But it will be like that. I can say that in general in Ukraine, women they are powerful traditionally. Also, if you like take a look into traditional culture, like folklore. So for us, it's rather something that we have to regain somehow, like maybe not really start from zero, but just to fix it on a new level of like contemporary society, in which, as was already many times mentioned today, like it's important to have this dialect, to have a shared action, not only to have this like resilience all alone, but to share it all together, all genders actually. So yeah, thank you.
So I think we need to go back to the great room. Before we do, Chika-san, any thoughts? I mean, you talked about the younger generation being powerful for role models. We're now talking about the older generation also being great for role models. How do you see it in Japan?
Yeah, there are some kind of older generation who kind of were pioneering and building their own careers or pursue their what they want to do. So these we have, as she said, we have such a powerful women as a role models. Yeah. But in a reality, most of the female working in not just the arts and cultural sector, they are really struggling to find the cross role models.
Yes.
Oh, if she became take that leadership role, then I can also think to considering to, you know, the promoting to that position, that kind of thing. So, so to do that, probably, I think in the government or bigger companies in Japan, they have some called quota system.
Quota
system. So, something similar can be maybe. It's worth trying to get that kind of system in amongst arts and culture sector, and also some job like system that allow job sharing or flexible working, so that the women can continue their career. So that kind of system change will more needed in Japan, I think.
I think. You are clearly a great role model for people working in the arts and culture here in Japan. And so I'd just like to thank both my panelists here and then pass back to Nina in the great room.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you, Chika, Natalia. And we all have to go out and get a Japanese granny, apparently. So I'm really sorry. That's all we've got time for, really. So big thanks again to Carolyn, the Department for Business and Trade and the UK Pavilion team. For sharing in this really fascinating conversation. We could have talked for ages, couldn't we? We've all got to get to work and stuff like that. We have heard today that, sadly, gender inequality does still exist in power, pay and policy, but we've also heard that stuff is changing, you know, data transparency, things like that. They are having an impact. Things are getting better. We are talking about it. Now we need to start talking about our new AI world, which I must confess leaves me absolutely confused, and which I know I need to apply myself more, because there is some very serious stuff happening in terms of gender in that particular field. I want to thank you all for my in-person audience and our online audience as well for joining us here today. Please follow RSA and UK at Expo channels for your future events, and above all, thank you for all your support. Thank you for your questions. Sorry we didn't have much of an opportunity to take many more questions, but it's been great having you here. Plenty of food for thought. Thank you so much to Penny and Sakshi. Brilliant stuff. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.